5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
How about we do it again?
6, 7, 4, 3, 2, 1. I think I spotted it.
Okay, let's try one more time.
I definitely did.
Why can't we move you?
Why can't we move you?
Say six.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello, podcast listeners. You found your way to episode 285 of the Rank and Review podcast, Mission Impossible Volume 2. This is the voice of your host and random Canadian Larry Parsons, and I'll be joined once again by the Beckman to help me rank the second half of the Tom Cruise Mission Impossibles, or at least as many as exist up to 2026. We're going to talk about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible Fallout, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, and Mission Impossible Final Reckoning. And then we're going to rank all 8 of them. That is the business that you are putting in your ears today, and you should go into it with the understanding that we are going to be talking spoilers for the Mission Impossible franchise, and there'll probably be coarse language, most particularly from me. If you enjoy Rank and Review, I bet you would also enjoy the Shelf-Shedding Movie Show, which is hosted by Mr. Jason Dupree, longtime friend of mine and forever friend of Rank and Review, so please give him your support. Please send your feedback to rankandreview@gmail.com. That's rankandreview@gmail.com. Consider checking us out on YouTube. I've got a very small presence on YouTube, but if you were to leave your ranks underneath the podcast or check out some of the isolated reviews, throw a like, throw a comment, throw a subscription, all of this I will see and appreciate, and all of this will help more eyes find their way, and hopefully eventually ears find their way to Rank and Review. But you didn't come here to listen to me prattle on about my desperate need for more ears on the podcast. You're here to hear about Mission Impossible and how things are going to rank. So I'm not going to stand in your way. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, etc. Mr. Beckman.
What up?
Lee Beckman. Back on the podcast, we had a mission, and we chose to accept it. But, much like Ethan Hunt in most, if not all, of these movies, we're going under the radar. We're going rogue. We're going...
How many puns can you get in there?
I mean, we're talking Mission Impossible. We can squeeze this in. But
instead
of doing this one at a time now, where we've been talking on the phone like we did for the previous episode, I have Lee in my basement, and we're going to finish the recording all live on the mic here. I still broke up my viewing. I watched them separately. At the time of recording now, you're hearing I am all caught up on the Mission Impossible. But how are they going to rank, and where is everything going to situate? How many spoilers? How many swears? This is sort of the where we are with this episode of Rank and Review.
Yeah.
Halfway through, where are you standing with Mission Impossible? Hands in the air, happy.
Yes, yes. And I will try. You know, fuck it. I'm going to sing it. Dun 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 dun. Beatbox. Dun dun dun. Okay, we'll stop. No, it's good to see you, Parsons. We're on the cusp of 2026. What better way to sort of end this year with a whole lot of cruise? Whole lot of Tom Cruise.
I do believe that there'll probably be some sort of legacy sequel or some form or shape of reimagining of the Mission Impossible franchise, but
yep.
This does feel like
we're doing the complete cruise era Mission Impossible right now.
It's a whole lot of cruise.
Yeah. So, is there anything you want to say by way of introduction before we list off the movies that we're going to review and then review those movies?
No, just happy to be here. Just happy to talk about a whole lot of, like, spies ripping off, you know, face masks and car chases and exotic locations and, you know...
Yeah, the sci-fi masks might be the one thing I would want to, like, take out if I had a magic wand and could remove something from the series.
It's a TV show, though.
Yeah, I guess. It just feels very sci-fi to me. I don't know, I never quite got used to it, but it's here to stay. I understand it's part of the format, and it's not a deal-breaker for me or anything like that.
It's funny, because they do mention it quite a bit in these screenplays when they're criticizing MI6, that it's a bunch of people, you know, playing trick-or-treat with masks.
Yeah.
So I do think they acknowledge the sort of goofiness of this and how probably in the real world it would not work, but meh.
And they actually had characters, like, grabbing other characters by the face to make sure they're actually talking who they think they're talking to, which we sort of, like, heckled in previous, you know, viewings of the Mission Impossible.
But I do like the fact that they, like, this series does acknowledge... Not even with the face masks, and we'll get to the punchline with the Last Reckoning, with the whole running thing, but they do acknowledge, I guess, the cliches or the ridiculousness of this film series somewhat, and I wouldn't call it meta, but I do like they acknowledge it.
Yeah. No, and I think it might have more to do with it, understanding its roots more than I do. Like I say, I don't... have a pretty close relationship with either the original show or the 1980s. They did a new vamped version of
it. They did. So. Well, I don't want to act like an expert. You know, I've seen a couple of episodes. This is more just the research. And
it's an echo of a memory. We're going to review Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Mm.
We're going to review Mission Impossible Fallout.
Mm.
We're going to review Mission Impossible
Dead
Reckoning. That used to be Dead Reckoning Part 1, but now we'll just call Dead Reckoning.
Yes.
And then we're going to finish it up with Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. And then we're going to rank all 8 Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movies.
So exciting!
And there's going to be spoilers.
Yes,
there will be spoilers. And there's going to be fucking swears. Shit.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Sorry, my bad.
Oops. Fucker.
Let's do this. What does he always say? Let's light the fuse.
The Syndicate is real. A rogue nation trained to do what we do.
An anti-IMF.
Ready or not, here I come.
They're coming after us with everything they've got.
You ready?
This may very well be our last mission. Let's make it count.
So what's the play?
You want to bring down the Syndicate? It's impossible.
Ready or not, here I come. Can't hide. Gonna find you. And take it slowly.
How do you know we can trust her?
Desperate times. Desperate measures.
You have your seatbelt on? You asking me that now?
Oh, hey, boys, what did I miss? Ethan?
Benji? Open the door! Open the door! Yeah, I'm trying.
Oh, my God. So I've been saying throughout the previous episode on Mission Impossible that the movies have been improving. This, I feel like, improves or continues for me with Rogue Nation in that the series continues to improve here. I like it starts at like 1,000% and it doesn't really give you a lot of breathing room. It explains what's going on, but you don't ever feel bogged down in exposition. And it has a really, really great villain, played by Sean Harris.
Yes, Solomon Lane.
Sounds
like a fish, but okay.
But we have, like, right away, we see him right at the very beginning of the movie. We have a face to put on this guy. We know that he's ruthless. We know that he's smart enough to get Ethan while he believes he's safe, and he murders this innocent woman in front of Ethan, like, right away. We have someone to hate, we have someone to cheer for, and, you know, Ethan's already captured and on the ropes when we get there. And this is the era where Christopher McQuarrie takes over directing and at least contributes, I imagine, pretty substantially to all of the screenplays going forward. And I can understand, especially after this movie, Cruz, you know, saying, yeah, let's keep going here. This, we're stepping pretty confidently. They'd work together with the Live, Die, Repeat and
Reacher?
The Reacher movies. Jack Reacher movies. So they had a good sort of shorthand together. And I've sort of wondered in the past if is it McQuarrie's ability to, like, bend the script to Tom's will, or do they have a genuine simpatico relationship? What is it about McQuarrie that he stuck around for four movies where no other director came back? I really, really, really like this one. We have the injection of Rebecca Ferguson and the return of Jeremy Renner and our standard crew. The movie series has started to understand that it's hard for us to fear for Tom Cruise, for Ethan Hunt, but we can fear for his team, and utilizing that very, very well. And like I say, having a villain that we can really hate and really, like, really be energized and propelled through the movie by us wanting to see this comeuppance come. We really want, you know, we don't like seeing our team this beat up this early in the game. We don't like seeing, you know, Ethan helpless. And it's an ongoing thing that I've mentioned and noticed throughout the series, how a lot of the times the big bad isn't necessarily defeated by Ethan. It's defeated by, you know, in one case his wife, or in another case fate, you know. In this case, Ethan is wronged. He takes it personally, and the whole movie is, in a weird way, a revenge story for Ethan. Huge fan sitting over here, but what does the Beckman think?
Well, it's definitely a vast improvement, and I liked Ghost Protocol quite a bit. But I think Tom Cruise owes a big white chocolate bunting cake that apparently he gives out every Christmas to Christopher McQuarrie, because I do think he actually saved Cruise's career. We have to go back. Let's go back in time a little bit, where at this point his wife has left him. The sheen has been worn off, and people are starting to not quite dig the megastar that is Tom Cruise.
It doesn't go without saying that everything he's in is a hit.
Yeah, but I think they had Cruise and company had realized that. And Christopher McQuarrie, if you look at his films, like his first one was Way of the Gun, which was both serious but he could balance both the action and the comedy quite well. Even his Jack Reacher, which I will say Cruise is heavily miscast, is both a very funny but also tense action thriller, and he balances that well. And utilizes those things quite well in Rogue Nation. He also realizes that, yes, Ethan Hunt had been somewhat invincible, but to get to him is, you know, you have to use his family. But he wanted Ethan to go on this hero's journey, and the hero has to overcome something. He knew that the audience also loved seeing the living Crayola kicked out of Tom Cruise, even with, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, Kill, Die, Repeat, whatever name you want to use for that film, where people love seeing Tom Cruise die and repeatedly in most ways. And Ethan Hunt is beaten to shit in this movie. He is basically, you know, in a car accident. There's the big fight sequence on top of an opera house. I think it's in Belgium, is it? Anyways, he has this sort of look that, you know, both, you know, John McClane from Die Hard, you know, Indiana Jones has, the sort of, oh my God, now what kind of look. And they really focused on the whole, how much punishment can Ethan Hunt take?
They also kind of have their cake and eat it too, in that he seems pretty helpless when it comes to the Sean Harris and this whole sort of evil secret syndicate.
Yeah.
But when it comes to evading capture or pulling off his individual goals, he's still Ethan Hunt. He still feels pretty invincible. Like, he's living one of the most wanted human beings in the world, and he can still globetrot and evade capture with kind of a smug smile on his face most of the time.
Yeah. But I'll say there's that underwater sequence where, you know, Cruise had to train for a year long training his breath, where he's got to get some sort of disc or chip in the security system underwater, and he is not really successful. I mean, he is, but Ilsa Faust saves him, and she is really the standout heartbeat of this film. I think it was a masterstroke to bring in Rebecca Ferguson as Ilsa Faust. The whole will she or is she or isn't she like a hero villain? Because like we do go bounce back and
forth. She's a British spy who's already embedded in the secret syndicate of former bad people, or you know, all of them used to work for various agencies around the world. They're all considered dead, but now they're doing these secret strikes, secretly manipulating the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, classic sort of Bond villain type of stuff. But she's inside already trying to investigate, so she doesn't really want to hurt anybody who she knows is an innocent or another sort of, you know, investigatory factor.
Yeah.
But she doesn't want to complicate the seat that she's sitting in, so
yeah.
It puts her in a weird spot. I really love this movie, but it does establish something that a lot of the Mission Impossibles have and will continue to have, and that this belief that there's nobody going on behind the scenes, like the opera sequence being a really good example. This is a huge opera where they know that there's a, you know, government officials and a lot of, you know, important people are present, and they want us to believe that there's no staff backstage up, you know, whatsoever, for the sake of the action scene.
Yeah.
And honestly, while it was happening, I let it go. It wasn't until the movie was over where I had that conversation, right?
And that's part of the problem. And, I mean, even though I was going to talk about this, you know, with Fallout, I figured out that one of the main problems with this movie is, because it is really based on the action, is that they would plan these amazing action sequences. How they would start off with the makings of these movies is they'd spend all this time and energy creating these action set pieces and then create the story around them. And they do make this up as we go along. Yes, the Syndicate is from the TV show, and it's actually it was or is a real life organized crime organization as well. Apparently it did exist, but the Syndicate in this form is from the TV show. As much as Solomon Lane and the Syndicate are villains, I think the real villains are actually, are the governments, both the British and American governments, because what is really Solomon Lane's ultimate goal here?
Well, he didn't like that he spent his life, punching other people's tickets and committing all of these crimes for the will of people he thought were noble that turned out were not.
Yeah.
He knows himself that he's not noble, but he figures if he's going to be this guy that can do these things,
yeah,
he doesn't want a rule book to follow.
Well, to me, it was when he does his whole ultimate, like, his motivation for doing what he's doing, he does talk about how quite personal and believable his drive is. He's been this tool used by this case, the British government, to kill a whole bunch of people just because they said so. And he's become so dehumanized by it that he sort of acknowledges that he is Frankenstein's monster, and that, you know, the people running MI6, the, you know, British Intelligence Agency, and the Prime Minister, they're Victor Frankenstein. And I kind of loved that motivation. It gave me a little bit of empathy towards him. I mean, he's still the big bad, but the fact that he got tired of being this tool for really, who's really the villains out there? I'm killing these people, but are they the bad guys? Or
yeah. I kind of got a bit of a Joker vibe in that was the story he told himself and projected,
but
in reality, he was a narcissistic control freak, and it was about having his will rendered and put before him.
Yeah.
And, defeating the Tom Cruise character. Like, at the very beginning of the movie, he gasses him in a box, kills this innocent woman in front of him, and all of it is a calculated thing so that Cruise will start to try to hunt him down because...
Yeah. There is narcissism to him. Like, don't get me wrong, he is an antagonist, but I do like that notion that here are these people that I'm sure do exist in our world who do kill for our governments. Like, what happens to them? Like, even if you're a sociopathic, there has to be an element of, I'm taking these people out because bureaucrats are telling me to do so. But what if the people I'm killing are actually innocent, or are we the villains here?
And basically the job was to do your killing and not think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, obviously Solomon Lane had. So, I don't know, that kind of, especially for an action film where it's
but he's still willing to kill someone just to piss Ethan off.
So yeah, like, well, because he probably thinks Ethan used to be him and probably has this hatred for him.
He spreads viruses in the world and downs airplanes because there's one person on there that he wants to kill. Like, he's a big bad. And that's a part of why the payoff at the end of the movie is so great. Like, they don't give him a big Bond villain death, or like they don't have a fight over a teetering whatever on the edge of a whatever.
Yeah.
But Tom Cruise, after, to be fair, months and months, over a year, finally figures this guy out, that it is about control. It is about everything is meticulously planned, and whatever you're doing, he has foreseen ahead of time. Yeah. And he uses that, your overconfidence is your weakness. Yeah. He uses that psychology within him in order to entrap him, and it pays off deliciously because he says over the radio, even though Benji's wired to a bomb, he's like, this is going to happen, and this is how I know I'm going to put you in a box.
Yeah.
And then a few minutes later, he legit puts this dude in a box.
Yeah.
And it's better than any explosion or anything like that, seeing how outraged and defeated he is, not killed but defeated.
Yeah.
Our villain is such a satisfying dramatic payoff at the end of this movie. Like, and that it's not just Tom Cruise, the entire team look at this guy and give him the fuck you stare.
Yeah,
right?
It's one of those, yeah,
you thought you had us, you had me wired to a bomb a few minutes ago, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
And it like, more than any other, it was very satisfying at the end of this movie to see the smugness wiped off of Sean Harris's face. Yeah, you're just like, yes, thank you.
Yeah. I do want to talk about Benji, because I think Benji probably gets the most time, with the exception of our villain and Tom Cruise. You know, he has wanted for a couple of movies, and he was somewhat. I mean, he did get in on the action with Ghost Protocol, but he wants to be more than a field agent. And can you hit pause for a second?
Yeah.
Yeah, anyways, Benji, he so desperately wants to be this field agent, and boy does he get that opportunity. I mean, not only does he get into a car chase with Tom Cruise where they both are like, whoa, but he is ultimately kidnapped by Solomon Lane, and him and Ilsa are used as bait. I love the journey that Simon Pegg's character gets what he wants, but I think deeply regrets it. I also love how they use Brandt. He's a little more of a bureaucrat in this one than last, but they still use him quite well. They bring Luther back in a really good way. But I also want to, you know, they bring in Alec Baldwin, who also is, I think, is the head of the CIA at this point, and has this whole look upon his face. He thinks he's so right for a good portion of the film, and then soon realizes how wrong he is. And I think they utilize Alec Baldwin quite well in this film. I also want to mention that amazing bike chase sequence.
Yeah.
We had a great... I know we had a good bike chase sequence in number two, in the second one, but...
This is way better.
Oh, it is. Like, the use of sound, how the shots, Macquarie has the camera up, really up in the actors' faces. We feel the danger a lot better with this chase sequence. Like, the cars just race on by. I don't know what kind of cameras and filters they used, but it is so well put together. And even how Cruise, you know, turns on his bike. I don't know. It's a really good chase sequence. And it even ends with him being flung from his bike because Ilsa stands in the way.
Yeah, and she knows his weakness as well.
Yeah. Which is why I love Ilsa so much.
No, the bike chase actually outdid the whole water coolant. get the chip inside it thing for me for a couple of reasons. I know he trained to hold his breath for a really long time, and I know that he was legitimately underwater as they shot a lot of it.
Yeah.
But it feels CG, like it doesn't feel as impressive.
Yeah.
And he's got this silly oxygen monitor on his arm.
Yeah.
Like he would be need to be told when he was physically out of oxygen. Like,
yeah,
you know, because your lungs and brain and body are exploding with the idea of you need air right now. There's that he would need a visual monitor on his arm seemed kind of ridiculous to me.
But
it was not for him. It was for us.
Yeah. But it also, I think, explains the risks a little better. And that's another thing I do like about the series is, to show how dangerous they is, they have to, you know, explain a little science in that sort of way, and I appreciated that. I also had it got me in the feels, and like not like emotional feels, but there's that line where Ilsa comes up near the end and says, "I can give you three choices," and I think option three was run away with me. I remember seeing that in the theater and go, and I actually said, run away with her.
Door number three.
Run away
with her. It's Rebecca Ferguson.
It got me in the feels. It did. And like not like the emotional feels, the different kind of feels.
I do like her as an actor. I like this character here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're going to keep using her going forward. And I like that she's sort of injected in the story. Like, she's got her own agenda that she's got to be careful about how she reveals her cards.
Yeah.
But it becomes obvious very early that she's not interested in any harm coming to Tom or his team.
Yeah.
But that the people that she's working under can't know this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I also love the side bad guy known as the Bone Doctor.
Right.
I think they use... I don't know who the actor is right now, but it was sort of a good sort of secondary villain.
And that he has a knife fight with Ilsa that's like pretty high stakes.
Oh yeah.
Again, we can't really fear for Ethan, but we can fear for Ilsa a little bit. We can fear for Benji a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm happy that you mentioned the fight sequences. They seemed a little more brutal as well. And that also comes, like, if you watch Jack Reacher again, like those fight sequences are like, ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch, ouch. And so that's the thing that I think McQuarrie brought to this as well. Of course, we also have a cruise run, although it is very scattered in this movie.
He does some running.
I mean, he does run for 45 seconds or 0.46 kilometers. But it's not... There's no big running sequence besides any wonder of the world.
Right.
For some reason, they didn't do that. I mean, we did have the cruise run, but... It's nothing like, you know, against the Taj Mahal or this, you know, famous Australian airport. It's not there, which is interesting.
But I do have to say, this one definitely was like, I've been enjoying myself. Like, I was really hard on Mission Impossible 2, I think maybe deservedly, and maybe a little bit too hard on Mission Impossible 1, but I keep on saying with each one they're getting better. I'm at the point now where I'm like actively into it. Like, I'm like, yes, bring on the next Mission Impossible. I'm here for it. Yeah. I kind of regret not seeing that on the big screen. I had that thought a few times with some of the action sequences. Yeah. It's still great to see projected up on my wall or on a good TV, I'm sure. But
yeah.
I understand now what people mean when they talk about it. This is sort of good high-scale budget. Action. Big budget action. You know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I second that emotion, but I do say it's the perfect blend of comedy and action that I don't think the series had perfected as well, or perfected, that's the wrong word, had used as well as it is here.
Yeah, you can have levity as long as it doesn't undercut the stakes. Like, I wouldn't call it a comedy, but it does have lines that'll make you laugh or smile.
Well, there's that great scene right after Cruz has been saved by Ilsa and Benji comes running in. And you can see Ilsa's character in the background, and Benji, he's in the foreground, you know, yapping away, and all of a sudden he gets zapped by Ilsa and thunk, and she grabs whatever that disc is, or whatever it is, like, it's some sort of knock list is on it, which has been the whole heist this is about, and she runs off it. It's very funny, and it made me laugh, and it's a great foil for, and Simon Pegg's a great foil in this.
But yeah, and he'd still done his job, because despite that, despite not seeing that coming, he had backed up that info, so they still had. They didn't lose the. I think it was banking information. Now that my memory is returned,
because it is banking information for the syndicate.
Yeah, that's because what it is. That's how Tom Cruise makes himself the information conduit. He memorizes this entire thing in like an hour somehow. Because there's nothing Ethan Hunt can't do.
No, he is.
There is like elements of silly to this, but it's so high stakes and fun and exciting the whole time that it's the only long after you've watched the movie that any of that really comes up, and they're quibbles. The movie is trying to entertain you, and it does.
Yes. Yes.
Good enough?
Good enough.
Ethan, that's not who we are.
Maybe we need to reconsider that.
So, how is he?
Oh, you know, same old Ethan.
Doing?
I find it best not to look.
Mission Impossible Fallout. Three plutonium cores have slipped through Ethan's fingers, and he needs to get them back. But he has got several obstacles.
Obstacles?
Yes. It's sort of been almost a running gag at this point in the series how often he goes, you know, off books or rogue or whatever to in order to get the job done. And the powers that be decide that in this case, especially since he's responsible for losing these cores, that he needs someone to keep a leash on him. And they hire Superman, Henry Cavill, August Walker.
Yes.
To basically keep an eye and just frustrate and stymie all of the moves that Ethan just wants to make without, you know, having anybody looking over his shoulder. But he is personally invested in getting this plutonium back because he knows no good will come of it if it gets into the wrong hands. And there's this weird cult that sort of worships the...
The end of the world. Creating a new world order, yes.
Yeah.
The apostles.
The apostles, thank you. That, we need to start again, and it'll be painful, but in the end, good for us to blow everybody up. Too many people. Let's level the playing ground with all of these nuclear toys we've developed.
Yeah.
So again, the stakes are high. I had a little bit of this spoiled to me because I think it was hard to avoid. There's a very famous action sequence in a bathroom.
Yeah.
And a meme of Henry Cavill
reloading his arms
or whatever. And I know that this was a very beloved entry. So I might have carried a little bit of baggage going into like, this one's going to be fucking amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really good. I think it's actually rock solid. But I think I'm going to put it just slightly under the previous entry. For some of the sameness that we get in it.
Okay.
Sean Harris has worked back into the plot in that one of the things he has to do in order to get his cores back is to release this guy. And, of course, Ethan Hunt is not interested in this guy being set free upon the world. And, again, he still has to stop this from falling into the wrong hands. So, yeah, there's a lot of balls in the air, but I feel like that was the previous entry, and then Rebecca Ferguson is back, and we definitely know she's on the good side, but she's still sort of doing that sort of shadow work thing. So it's the same as the previous film, although we kind of know the outcome. We know who Elsa is now.
Yeah.
And we have Henry Cavill, who just has to be the bad guy. Like, I don't know if that's seriously a reveal that the movie was trying to keep from us, but, like, he just has to be the bad guy.
Yeah,
and
it's
inevitably, of course, he is the bad guy. And it also does feel like we're ahead of it, and so necessarily we kind of wonder why our hero is. And then it's revealed that our hero is also ahead of it, but it's played as a reveal. But I feel like if we're ahead of it, it should go without saying that yeah. Ethan is ahead of it. But while you're watching it, all of these action sequences, the famous opening with Tom Cruise clinging onto the side of the plane, the, you know, how's he gonna, you know, get the job done with people breathing down his neck, mm-hmm. the admittedly badass fight sequence in the bathroom, like Tom Cruise flying an actual helicopter, and like it is very, very, very aggressively entertaining. For me, just the slightest stitch down from the previous entry, but I'm not mad at it. I'm not like, oh, this is disappointing in any way. Mm-hmm. It's still, I think, rock solid. I don't think it gets properly rickety until the next entry.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, for me, just like the dark silhouette that hands Ethan his next assignment in the book of Homer's The Odyssey, to me, Fallout is darker in story, theme, and in aesthetic. I mean, it's shot way darker by director of photography Rob Hardy, which I appreciate. There's also very little humor. Like, this film is very serious, like a heart attack. I kind of got thinking, like, there seems to be, like, I don't know if it's homages, but they're referencing, like, those old 70s Paramount thrillers, such as, like, 3 Days of the Condors when watching this film. They also, you know, kind of do a bookend to the whole, the struggles that these agents have with their private lives, because, you know, Ethan's marriage is like long gone by this point, but they do end this whole narrative with him and the wife from Mission Impossible 3. I forget the actor's name right now.
Michelle Monaghan,
but her character's name, which I also, it provides a lot more gravitas and pathos. Like, it just seems the threat is a lot more real this time. And as I alluded in the past review, though, once again, the action set pieces are what they plan so much, and then they move the story along. If you stop and you think about it, like, the plot doesn't make a lot of sense. And all, really, that John Lark had to do was, like, to walk up to Ethan at one point and put 2 bullets in his head, and that would be it, but then the movie would be over. Like, they go to such insane lengths to try and carry out, like, the stealing of the nuclear plutonium cores, and then try and get Solomon Lane out, and then, you know, they have the, you know, the big climax fight at the end, when in reality all John Lark really had to do, and he even mentions it when Cruise has that great long running sequence in England over like the rooftops and whatnot, where Lark looks down at him and goes, "For some reason, you know, my boss wants you alive just to bear witness." So I guess they do acknowledge it a little bit about how...
No, he has to suffer. He has to live, but his wife and his friends have to die, and he has to know that it was all the syndicate, and he'd have not messed with their work, it wouldn't have become this personal thing, blah, blah, blah.
But as I tried to sort of look through the logic of the movie, which was sort of... It's folly to do so. If that's the case, like, if John Lark is at first trying to be the spy, this sort of covert spy working for Angela Bassett, who's introduced in this movie, then it logically didn't make sense. Like, how are the apostles stealing the plutonium core and doing all this stuff? Like, it didn't make any logical sense. But then I went, ah, fuck it, it's a spy movie. Well, so let's just keep
that's
going.
The amorphous cult. There's this cult that has far-reaching tentacles into every, you know, finger of the workings of the government or the CIA or the whatever.
Yeah.
And they'll replace that with something else in the next movie. But
yeah,
any kind of plot hole like that can just be written off in that way.
Yeah.
Somebody somewhere made it happen.
Yeah. I have Fallout actually a good tick a bunch, Rogue Nation, because the action stunt pieces are amazing. That jump, that halo jump that they did in Cruise, it took a year for Cruise to practice that and do it safely, along with the cameraman who shoots it. It's not Henry Cavill who actually jumps. It is actually the stuntman that he'd been practicing with for a year, and then they added like the CGI lightning. I watched this shot, you know, many times, because there's that shot where Cavill, you know, is walking to the plane and then jumps off. But I don't know how they did it, because it might be Cavill, you know, walking first, and then somewhere, either he moved to the camera to the side, and the actual stunt cameraman then, you know, went in and jumped, or they superimposed Cavill's face over the stuntman. I don't know, but just the use of, you know, music, sound, the idea of the lightning and the halo jump itself, like that is Cruise, is impressive. And then it segues into the White Widow, who is actually the daughter of Max from the first Mission Impossible. We're introduced to that character as well, who's really, really cool. And then we have that amazing fight sequence, and it's brutal. I do want to shout out the other actor stunt person's name here. I hope I'm saying this correctly. Liang Yang is this famous actor stuntman. He did a lot of the sword fights for the last Star Wars.
And he has to do this whole fight sequence with a briefcase attached to his arm. So it's an added layer of complication.
Yeah, originally it was supposed to be 3 days, but it lasted 3 weeks. But yeah, like they were shooting for so long that whole, you know, reloading of the shotgun of the arms with Henry Cavill, he was so tired, he says. It was just one of those, okay.
Something that happened.
And it looked good. But I mean, they are thrown, you know, over like sinks, mirrors. I mean, if you can watch the making of it online and the fact that it's a lot of foam.
It's really good, but it's also any fight sequence from the Raid movies.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't better action sequences, but once again, this is one of those of jeebus, ouch.
No, the punches land and the hits hurt, for sure.
So I guess going from the halo jump, which was impressive, and shot on those, you know, the IMAX cameras and filters as well, like, seeing it in the theater, like, there's that one beautiful long shot of all the clouds and the lightning going off to that, like, that's a really great... It's not quite the opening, because we also have the opening where they try and get that one of the members of the Apostles to give up the information. But that 1-2 punch, and then you're introduced to the White Widow, and then we get the whole thing with the London. And even though we are ahead, and we soon realize that so is the team, that they know that John Lark is the bad guy here. The script just seems... Everything seems tighter. Like, the editing is tighter and crisper. The lines are better. And what happened was, is that beautiful chase sequence, Tom Cruise broke his ankle.
Yeah.
They kept it in the movie. You can watch it. When he jumps and he tries to latch onto the edge, you can actually see his ankle.
Yeah,
but it's a beautiful run sequence of 48 seconds and 0.08 kilometers in fallout. Yes, I will get to the punchline there. But, I don't know. Because of that 2-month break that they had to do, McQuarrie could then go back and work on the dialogue and work out the story. Everything seems tighter, more structured. The dialogue, while it's not exactly Shakespeare, seems a little more polished. And because Cruise has said that, you know, these films rely really on not what is said but what it is done, it just seemed like a stronger picture altogether. The fact that also it is a darkly shot movie, and it is dark, dark, dark. For a film that is battling between the action and comedy, and they managed to really stay pretty serious with this, I thought, good on you, because it is ridiculous in a lot of ways.
What did you think of the treatment of the Alec Baldwin character? Because we joked in the past that they always had like a different celebrity handler, going from movie to movie, and hey, look, he made it for 2 movies, but he won't be coming back for a third.
Well, I mean, I know it was coming. It was fine, Alec Baldwin. It was nice to see you. Originally, that was supposed to be Jeremy Renner, but he wanted more money, and they were going to kill him off, like, in the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And he didn't want that, so they had to do a sort of, like, a 180 and say, hey, Alec Baldwin, you know, to give the story a little more pull and drama, we're going to kill you off. But the original plan was to have Brandt execute, but Renner decided not to come back, so that's that was there.
Because I don't know, I feel like it's kind of cool that they brought him back, but because they hadn't brought anyone else back, I thought like, oh, maybe we're actually gonna have like a new sort of support. Nope.
And for a while there, I thought, and spoilers, Angela Bassett might get it as well, but Anyways, Alec Baldwin, it was nice to see you, but, I mean, like I said, original...
Non-essential, obviously, and again, yeah. It just provides higher stakes and makes us hate the baddie a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, the needing to get the detonator from Cavill, and he's in a, you know, helicopter flying away, and that whole chase sequence, and everybody else has to rig this impossible-to-rig bomb and wait and see somehow how, you know, Ethan's gonna make it work.
What did you think of that final helicopter sequence? Because that was another one where they practiced and practiced and practiced. And once again, that is Cavill up in the helicopter, even though it's got a stunt pilot. But Cruise is flying. I highly recommend watching the making of those action set pieces and what they had to plan. Because, once again, oh my. Like, it's kind of thrilling, man. Even with Cruise falling from the helicopter and landing on what that big sack that the helicopter is carrying. Oh my. I don't know. It's impressive stunt action filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's good, and I guess this is a complaint you can make of any sort of franchise or superhero movie, so take it as that. I could never worry that he's going to really fall off the plane to his death, right? Like,
sure, fair enough.
Again, we there's almost more stakes with the team and his wife back at the quarry or whatever it was.
I guess I appreciate, and this is something that, because CGI changed how the action genre was done,
they did not go that route.
Yeah, they don't. They try and go as practical as much as they can. And Cruise knows this. Like, I'll give him credit for this. He is such a showman in that sort of regard, that try and make things as practical where we can believe it and have a general ooh, ah. Like, that's him falling. That's him flying the helicopter. It's him going into a tailspin.
No, and I do appreciate it. In the age of, like, completely CGI car chases, yeah. Blah.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. You know, we're spending all this money to, you know, to get, you know, entertained and thrilled. The fact that they did risk their well-being, although I'm sure they practiced over and over and over and over and over again.
If you're getting paid $20 million to do a movie, yeah. Like, again, yeah. I'm not saying die to make the movie, but...
Well, no one should die during because
of these... Earn it. Yeah. Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. Earn this. So, I don't know. I appreciate all the action sequences and the stunt fighting, all of it. It's so well executed. They also had the time because their lead actor broke his ankle. So, to me, Fallout is just a step above. Yes, it's another a variation on the theme. We've got more of Solomon Lane. Although, really, like I said, all you have to do is walk up to Ethan and put two in the back of his head and, you know, movie's done. But then...
What fun would that be?
Exactly. But... I don't know. I would put Fallout, if we were to have a conversation on the top 10 best action films of that decade, we would obviously have to talk about Fury Road, but I would put Fallout up in there because just the commitment of it, and it just feels like a tighter, crisper edited, better written action film than, say, Rogue Nation is. Take nothing.
It has good flow, and we would like that. Is something that I think I was starting to. I maybe have undervalued going forward because. Yeah.
Were you ever bored with Fallout?
I don't recall being bored.
Okay. Yeah. See, neither was I. Not that I wasn't bored with Rogue Nation, but there was little moments where I could feel it breathe a little bit. Where this just it even though it is like 2.5 hours long, it just felt. Tight. And even the end where they're running around looking for these bombs in this camp and whatnot, it felt like a better overall picture. So I'm a big fan of Fallout. I think it's the strongest of the series. Oops, spoilers. Oops. Yeah, I'm a big Fallout fan.
Again, I think it's very strong. Like, I don't know if I would say it's the strongest of the series, but I think it's very strong. Just because you're playing the same notes, in a lot of ways, that's what we're here. That's what we pay our money is to see the same notes, is to see these airplane stunts and to see Tom Cruise actually doing whatever the heck he's doing, jumping from building to building or from vehicle to vehicle or flying the helicopter. And it absolutely does deliver on that.
Yeah.
So, like, whatever hiccups I'm saying are just again. For the sixth entry in a series, it's a remarkably strong.
Ethan, what's your objective? What's your ultimate objective?
Your life will always matter more to me than my own.
None of our lives can matter more than this mission.
I don't accept that.
Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, or previously Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Yes.
A lot of things happening here. This is the first one that's very consciously like a two-parter.
Yeah.
In a way like that, like it's an interconnecting narrative. The things that are set up in this movie do not necessarily all pay off in this movie.
Yeah.
But I do think it is the point in the franchise where things start to get rickety.
Yeah.
Not due to them not knowing what Mission Impossible is, not because like they lost the team aspect, but because they kind of just got a little bit ahead of themselves. Like,
yep.
We yes. have hundreds of millions of dollars. We can do no wrong. Whatever we do will be the highest grossing movie of the year. We can make this shit up as we go along. Like, let's spend as much money as possible. Let's be as indulgent as possible and make the most epic two-part action sequence movie of all time. And they do earnestly try to do that. And in that effort, ended the franchise.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, playing with this much money without a confident script, or sometimes any script, is just irresponsible. Like, I can't respect it.
Yeah.
But I also think that the entity as a villain
yep.
is a mistake in that we have no face to put on it, and therefore less investment or hate to put towards it. It doesn't feel like a real sort of tangible villain. And they know they need one, so they invent one in this Nathaniel guy.
Yeah.
We sort of believe that there's this built-in history, but there kind of isn't. They kind of needed Sean Harris to come back, but my guess is Sean Harris had other things to do or something like that. We needed, like, a legacy villain for him to square off against, and then the entity as the big evil that needs to be stopped and shut down.
Yeah.
And, like, in this being the first half of the two-part thing, I think the action sequence payoffs, especially the train sequence at the end of the movie,
yeah.
delivers in a very positive way, in that, like, I don't walk away necessarily disappointed for my entertainment or my action value.
Yeah.
But I stop believing that the Mission Impossible series is even pretending to be smart anymore. With this entity, the entity villain is sort of an all-purpose cop-out. They don't have to explain anything the entity's doing because it's so far beyond us.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like I say, the sort of fake-out, built-in villain of this Nathaniel character. You do feel them ramping up the stakes, and they trying to sort of revisit some of the greatest hits, and showing Ethan on the ropes, and Ethan taking losses. And there's certainly more weight and spectacle and payoffs in this chapter than there is in the last chapter. But you can't help but feel this sort of softness in the center of the movie, where the center does not hold. This does not all make sense or even pretend to. It doesn't have the same propulsive energy as the other ones because of all the money they're spending and their need to make this so epic. Now they're like 2 hours and 45 minutes long. They're touching on the 3-hour mark. but they're not really expanding the story or the world or even the action sequences in a way to justify that. I think the mentality is just more is better. And I felt that more was not exactly better. And you can tell in the big moments of the movies, when a major character is killed off, it should be devastating to us, but it weirdly isn't. It just feels inevitable.
Yeah.
Like, this is the time where this needs to happen, because this is where our character is going to hit bottom and has to start turning things around. Like,
yeah.
I wasn't lost in it. During the last couple of entries, like, my background voice in my head that says, how'd they pull off that stunt, or does this line of, you know, dialogue make sense with the story? It completely shut up, and I was just lost in the fun spectacle of the action.
Yeah.
And this movie never really quite achieves that for me.
Yeah.
It's not bad, but it just doesn't achieve the same level that a lot of the previous chapters had.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head here. The creative process for these films, they do create the story on the fly. Like, it's an improv style kind of process when making of these movies. The original idea that they were going with is they were going to explore Ethan's, how did he originally join the MI6? And they originally cast the villain and had started shooting with Nicholas Howe, who was much younger than Asai Morales. And then COVID happened. And Nicholas Howe, you know, wasn't available because the shoot had been drawn out. And according to McQuarrie, they had shot the hell out of that backstory with the Gabriel character played by Asai Morales. But it was originally Nicholas Howe and this character Marie. And we only see it in that sort of black and white flashback.
It's all cutting room floor.
It is. Somewhere in the Paramount
vault. I assume that's Ethan's dark backstory, because you have to be caught doing something bad.
Right? Yeah, and that was the original thing. I suspect the entity was always going to be a part, I think, somewhat, but because they had to pivot, because COVID shut down production,
the entity took over.
They fell in love with this whole entity being the big bad, and they had to recast, so they chose an actor that was as old as Tom Cruise and Asai Morales, who had this career resurgence because of Ozark. So they pivoted. Instead of Nicholas Howe being the sort of megalomaniac who is, you know, just controlling this sort of AI, the AI itself became sort of the big bad that was using Gabriel.
Again, that's an explanation, but it's not a justification. Like, I'm sorry, if you are making movies on this scale with this budget,
yeah,
and you don't have a script yet, then you don't start shooting.
But that's Hollywood. I mean, like, even the Marvel films.
It's ridiculous.
No, I agree. Yeah. Look, I agree with you. And I think this is where they got caught.
Yeah.
Because they kind of went in circles. Once again, if you stop and you look about it, like, it is in, like, is it New Zealand or Australia, that airport sequence where we're introduced to Grace, is it? The thief, the Hayley Atwell character.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, that is actually well executed, well planned out, and Benji has to go and, you know, film the bomb. All of that seems, like, really well thought out and put together. But the plot is jumping all over the place. We get, you know, Palm, I forget her name, but she is this assassin that works with Gabriel, that Gabriel eventually betrays and whatnot.
Only betrays her because the entity told him that she would betray her, because the entity somehow knew that Ethan would spare her life.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, it's,
again, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. No, I know. But they fell, like I said, they fell in love with this whole idea of the entity. And, you know, and what was going on at the time. You know, people had started to realize that what is truth and what is not on the internet.
Right.
Like, there, you know, there was all these laws being passed both in Canada and in the States of, so much false information was being provided by mostly the right-wing medias or, you know, right-wing politicians to sort of confuse, you know,
us
sheeples, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty terrifying concept because, you know, what does the entity do? It wants to control what is truth. And that is a pretty scary thing.
Well, again, the movie keeps calling itself on itself. Like, the entity wants to wipe out humanity, and then what?
Yeah. But that's because they don't think really about that. They're no. so
they need a clock for Tom Cruise to stop.
Yeah. And they're more obsessive. Let's keep the story going, the film going, so we can get to the next big action set piece, which is in Rome. And here's something else. Tom Cruise starts to show his age in this movie. Like he's in his 60s at this point. Even though it's a great running sequence, he runs for 2.5 kilometers in the entire film, and there's that great shot of him trying to save Elsa. He looks older and he looks a little more tired.
And he's kind of on the ropes. Like, as he's running to save Ilsa, I think in his heart he kind of knows Ilsa's already dead, right?
Yeah, yeah. But as well, as soon as we're introduced to the Hayley Atwell character, it's then we don't need Ilsa. Now, the original plan was to kill Ilsa in the next film, but because they had all of a sudden all these narratives to play with, and the narrative of the end of day became bigger and bigger and bigger.
She was coming underfoot.
Yeah, like on the day they were shooting that nightclub sequence, it was actually Benji, Simon Pegg, who came up with the idea. Well, hey, why don't we get this sort of oval shaped icon and create that helicopter sound? So that could be sort of like, here comes the entity precursor. They came up with that on the day. And then so much so, well, if you've got the entity that can, get into all these, secret places on the internet, what could it do? And so the sequence that starts the film, that was the last thing shot. That was never part of the original plan, that whole Russian subway sequences, which is like key to the whole... They just came with that, thinking, okay, we need something to explain how dangerous the entity is. And so they had, it was, pickup shots, essentially. I mean, none of the full cast had to be there. They just had to show how dangerous the entity could be. And that's, and once again, goes to the whole, they didn't really have a schmaster plan, as you had once said. So
you need to have a plaster man, especially if you're spending this much money. And it's this far into the series, and people are expecting a certain amount of quality. Yeah. There's arrogance to that approach. It's basically, we'll use money to satisfy our every whim at any time. And as a result, the budget balloons, which makes it like necessary for your movie to become an epic blockbuster to even make any money.
Yeah.
And, it's infuriating for people who work in micro-budget film, who sweat the money and sweat every decision and have to be as prepared as possible to know that when you get to be able to make movies at this stage, you can just fucking wing it, is disheartening.
Yeah.
And as a fan of the franchise, and I wasn't when we started this, and I am now, I felt that disinterest in them. Like, I felt that, anything we do will be fine. We got this. And... No.
I want to make a correction. The airport is actually not in Australia. It's in Abu Dhabi. So
okay. I didn't know it all.
Yeah, so. No, it was actually in Abu Dhabi. And then it's in Poland where they do that whole train sequences. They completely rip off a video game called Uncharted 2, Drake's Revenge. It's still a thrilling sequence with the train sort of teetering over the edge and having Cruise and the Atwell character sort of dangling. But they literally steal it. Shot from that video game.
No, I'm not a video game guy, so I guess I didn't feel that. But I really like that final train sequence. And I have to give it, as much as I've been sounding negative about this, for a movie that comes built in without an ending, it does feel fairly satisfying at a conclusion. It's not like a, oh shit, cliffhanger. There's more story to tell, but like, it feels like enough's happened that this is a satisfactory end. And a lot of, quote, middle chapters or cliffhanger ending chapters really, really have a problem with that ending.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we're also,
I will give some points for that.
It's always good to see Henry Snurzy as well.
Cerny.
Henry Snurzy. Snurry?
Cerny.
Cerny.
Yeah.
Cerny. 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 Yeah, yeah, yeah. They bring him back all the way from the original, which is a nice touch, and then we get these other two sort of hitmen. Or
tying in the other movies in some ways that are comfortable and in some ways that are not.
But. But it's always good to see him. Also, Carrie Ewells?
Elwes.
I am like butchering
I'm
names.
I'm pretty sure it's Carrie Elwes, the Princess Bride.
Yeah. Good to see him as well. But yeah, it does sort of feel like they are rushing to get to like cool action sequence. And it's still cool, that whole motorcycle. They didn't have to do it, though. Like, the whole him riding off, you know, off the cliff and him jumping.
Well, they didn't, and they did. It's a Mission Impossible movie, yeah. So real stunts with actually Tom Cruise are a built-in component. I understand that.
Yeah.
Figuring in how to justify that, that's the job of the screenwriter.
Yes.
And again, if you say they were working backwards and setting train tracks as the train was running, so...
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that they're able to get that and pull it off, I mean, congratulations. Apparently Spielberg did the same thing for the third act of the second Jurassic Park movie. He just threw away the script and says, let's do this instead.
Yeah.
And part of me is like, wow, ballsy, respect, that's kind of cool. But another part of me says, man, with that much production, that much money, and that much talent on set, have a fucking plan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also, it's nice to see Vanessa Kirby as the White Widow return. Shea Whittingham as Briggs and Greg Tarzan Davis. I like that name. Greg Tarzan Davis. Those are the ones that worked.
I was bugged a little bit by Shea Whittingham for two reasons, but one of them is corrected somewhat in the next movie, and the other one was just me. But he was looking to me like a failed Michael Douglas clone for some reason.
Okay.
I don't know, just like the silver in his hair and the way he was shot. There was a few times I feel like this guy... Like, I've never thought that about the actor before, but it feels like it's almost like he's emulating a young Michael Douglas performance. And he's not. It's just something about the way he looks.
Yeah.
And the other thing is just the hard-on he has to kill Ethan in this. He just seems like he's unreasonable. But they
find out why.
Give us more information later on so that makes a little more sense.
Also, I want to get this name right. Palm Clementiff?
Yeah, she's in the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's a great side villain as Paris as well, which adds some spice. Also, too many homages and callbacks. I mean, that train sequence where him and Gabriel are fighting is clearly, you know, sort of a tip of the hat to the first mission as well.
Oh, we're going to see more of that,
though. Yeah, the Fiat chase is also a big sort of callback to Rogue Nation. We're starting to get just a couple more. Hey, remember how cool this was in this action film? Here it is. And that's... It brings a sense of familiarity to it, which I think also hurts this movie.
Well, and again, it has this effect, as I've said before in the podcast. Hey, guys, remember this other better movie?
Yeah.
Remember this wicked scene from a movie that's way better than the movie you're watching right now?
Yeah. 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 No, yeah. 100%. Look, Dead Reckoning is good, but considering how strong I think Rogue Nation and Fallout were... It does sort of feel like a step down.
Part of it is it's a victim of the previous movie's successes. Yeah. I will agree with that.
Yeah.
But part of it is just the whole conceit is that we can just make this up and it'll be good. Like, their overconfidence, their arrogance going into this.
Yep, yep. I mean, COVID did balloon the budget as well.
That'll be part of the problem. But I think a lot of it was just ego, honestly.
Sure. No, absolutely. But, you know, they had a structure that had worked for them and made them millionaires. So why mess with the recipe? But yes, it is the sort of arrogance of this worked before, it can work again.
And I saw an interview with Rebecca Ferguson where she was talking about, you know, the end of her character or whatever. And she's very grateful to the Mission Impossible franchise. It's been good for her career, high exposure.
Yeah.
But it's like 8 months of shooting, and most of it she's not actually working.
Yeah,
she said in the time it takes to shoot one Mission Impossible movie, she did like three movies and an entire series of
a
TV show. And it's actually limiting her work. In a way, it was a relief to get killed off.
Yeah.
So you'd think it would be a dream gig to be in the Mission Impossible series, but maybe not.
Well, you get paid well, though.
It's rickety and loud, but entertaining. The wheels have not come off, .. Yeah. Yet. Yeah.
Your team has been betrayed, Ethan. All your secrets compromised.
Everything you are. Everything you've done. Come to this.
You gave him an aircraft carrier?
Our lives are the sum of our choices. This is your calling. Your destiny. I have no regrets. Neither should you.
summer, 2025.
Yep.
Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Not Dead Reckoning Part 2 all of a sudden. All of a sudden they have to change that.
Yeah.
And that's what this movie sort of feels like in a lot of ways, is that like, gee, the previous movie didn't make as much money as we expected it to, and it certainly wasn't as reviewed and received as well as we wanted it to be, so holy shit, what are we going to do? What I feel here is kind of a sort of panic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, we got to give mm-hmm. them what we want. We got to have this big finish. And honestly, what I was expecting walking in was like to be just sort of bombarded by energy and action to the point that it would become overwhelming and exhausting and wear me out.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing thing about Final Reckoning is how nothing of substance happens for, I'm going to say, the first hour of the movie.
Okay.
And it's all of these scenes of explaining what has previously happened,
mm-hmm.
what needs to happen, mm-hmm. what's going to happen, mm-hmm. who needs to do what in order to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all done with this propulsive dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun energy. And in between the sequences, there's all these foreboding shots of people zooming to the next location to have their next intense conversation. But I just couldn't believe how much exposition happened and how mm-hmm. desperate it just felt. Like, the editing felt like they didn't know what to do with all the footage, and then they start mm-hmm. reincorporating images from previous Mission Impossible movies, once again reminding us of where we've come and how this is all culminating into this.
Mm-hmm.
Then, finally, an hour into the movie, we finally get to the wreckage, the submarine, and there's a sequence in there that's, you know, really technically difficult to pull off. And, you know, well-rendered. I'm like, okay, so now the movie starts. We finally got to the tipping point of the roller coaster, and the ride has begun. Nope. Nope. Right back to the explaining the plot and the, you know, what we're going to do next and who should do what and why we're not acting. And Nick Offerman's in the movie for some reason. And, like, it is almost 3 hours long. Yeah. And I could easily, as an amateur, cut an hour out of this movie. Like, yeah. It's amazingly bogged down and up its own ass and self-impressed. And it is one of the very worst entries in the Mission Impossible franchise. Mm-hmm. I said it was getting rickety and dangerously kind of unruly in the previous entry. The wheels come off.
Yep.
In this last entry.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, with Tom Cruise doing all these impressive bits with the big plane sequence at the end, and how is he doing that and dangling or whatever, the stakes are gone.
Mm.
And the payoffs just aren't there.
Yep.
As a big finish, it is hard to describe Final Reckoning as anything but a devastating disappointment. So that's where I start.
Okay.
What did the Beckman think of Final Reckoning?
I'm going to say it's hard to say goodbye to the ones that you love. I think that's the overall message that I walk away from Final Reckoning. At nearly 3 hours, this movie is bloated and fragmented with too many callbacks, plot lines, repetitive exposition scenes, and characters to serve. Too much. You did too much. Too much. And it hurts. But first, the payoff to the running Tom Cruise joke. It's interesting that I as much of a deep dive I did with the AI internet trying to get the official distance of time for the running of the film. The approximation they give is 0.049 kilometers with the highlight of Cruise running with no running time actually given. That's all it gave me. We got the highlight running sequence of his chase to and from Luther, but, you know, with the Westminster Bridge and Big Ben. I say this because, and he doesn't run the longest of the franchise. That still goes to Ghost Protocol. But for the final release of this movie, for the final Mission film, the filmmakers, the studio, along with a lot of IMF fans, which apparently there were many, they actually had a marathon in honor of this. As a sort of to say thank you to all the fans, and apparently it was in London, England. The total distance for that marathon, and the movie would play. That's the thing. Right. You would run to the movies.
Okay.
That was sort of the running joke of this whole thing. All these setups here, but here was the payoff. The actual distance for the marathon was 42.2 kilometers long. But yes, you as a fan, along with some of the cast, could have a run with our hunky Tom Cruise in honor of the release of the final reckoning, if you will.
But what did you think of the movie?
Okay, so I had to get that joke out of the way, because like they had built it and built it and built it, and like they knew that it was a bit of a joke. The problem was is that the original plan was to make this movie in a non-linear fashion. They were going to have a lot of, you know, callbacks, a lot of memories to put the to continue the narrative. But when they put the movie together, it didn't work. So they panicked. And they said, okay, we're going to move some scenes up. I suspect the Luther death scene was moved up where it was going to be originally at the end. The movie just feels fragmented and wonky because of it. Because they then put the story in a linear fashion, and that apparently worked a little bit better.
It's weird because, like, I believe you. I don't know any of the backstory, but I did feel like the Luther scene, they kill Ving Rhames' character off. Happened too early in the movie, and it caused two things to happen as a result.
Yep.
The sort of bottom point of Ethan's character was reached too early in the movie.
Yep.
And I did not fear for anyone else in the movie. For some reason, I felt like after that had happened, I'm not worried about Benji, I'm not worried about Hayley Atwell, I'm not really worried about the rest of the scene.
Yeah.
That whole sequence with Benji being badly injured at the end and trying to remain conscious while he talks his team through this highly technical problem, I think would have been significantly more suspenseful without that preamble.
Yeah.
And my God, the amount of monologuing that they gave to Ving Rhames.
Yeah.
Like, his entire life was dedicated to his friendship to Tom Cruise's character. And I thought it was ridiculous while it was happening in the actual scene, because there's a literal ticking clock down to the final second. And it's just like, my God. And then at the end of the film, they do go back to it, and the monologue goes on even longer. And I'm like, we've had this scene.
Yeah.
You don't need to double down on the emotional punch of it. It actually, if anything, is detracting from it.
I giggled, I won't lie, because it's too much.
It's way too much.
They had painted themselves into a corner with the whole entity thing. That's kind of what I also walked away with. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the original plan was to show the sort of backstory with this Mirella Gayerga character, and they, for the most part, completely abandoned it. They felt like they were setting up, and then
nope,
that's not what they're doing. They had to go back, and yes, they had to sort of reintroduce us to the entity, which we didn't need. We already knew that it was the threat. We didn't need that first, 5-10 minutes of it?
And again, it's because it's no longer part two, they felt they needed to reorient in case there's any newbies coming into the 8th entry of the Mission Impossible franchise. And they keep doubling down and doubling down. And I noticed this, like, they keep on giving us all of that information, but they didn't remind us about the character who was the partner of the Michael Douglas looking guy, the black CIA guy who sort of sided with Ethan.
Yeah.
We didn't have any of his backstory, so we didn't understand where he was coming from in that way, and they didn't feel the need to bend over backwards to explain it like they did everything else. Like, the choices were just baffling.
Yeah. We didn't really need to know about the rabbit's foot. It was actually sort of a dangerous code that eventually became the entity.
Interesting, but unnecessary.
Yeah, we didn't need to know that Jim Phelps' son was actually Shea Whittingham's character. I mean,
it did explain why he had such a
chip
on his shoulder for Tom Cruise.
But to the overall arc of the story, did it...
Minimal. Certain,
yeah, exactly.
Oh, they shook hands at the end? That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, isn't that nice? Too many callbacks.
I forgive you for killing my daddy.
Yeah. Yeah,
Shortful.
Yeah, too many callbacks. It was nice to see that character from the first mission, the one that was in Langley, that they sent to Alaska.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him at first, but that was kind of cool.
Yeah, and at least they used him well, but they'd spend so much time doing all these callbacks with these memory shots that it does bog the film down. And even though we do need to get to the submarine, like, did we really need another sort of fight sequence in the submarine where this, you know, this member of the apostle or the entity, excuse me.
It tries to take Tom Cruise
out. Like, yeah. It doesn't do anything, but
I think it did, because the action is so minimal for such a large movie that calls itself an action movie.
Yeah.
There is shockingly little action.
Yeah. Really, it's the airplane sequence in a lot of ways. But it because it's, like the middle of the picture is, I think, the slowest. It turns into sort of like a Jack Ryan kind of spy-esque film. It feels so bloated, and we didn't even need that. I know, like, I guess in some ways we needed some sort of action, but there's so much to cut, and oh my god, the exposition scenes. Ethan, you're the only one.
You caused this, but you're also the only one who can fix it. Also, we don't trust you, but we're going to trust you implicitly. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Over and over again.
Yes, you mean he was the one that was in the Kremlin bombing? He was the one that stole the knock list? He was the one that, you know, basically broke into all the intelligence agencies and knocked everyone out as Kittredge? Yes, we get it, Tom Cruise. You are McJesus.
The greatest hero that ever lived.
I get...
No, I think they successfully created, quote, American James Bond, I guess. But, yeah, no. Sean Connery is not this in love with himself.
You know what? Like, I was thinking about this, because there are so many Christ-like scenes of Tom Cruise. He is sort of the last big Hollywood star. Like, movie making has changed so much where, you know, Tarantino said it's not really about the actors, you know, being the draws anymore. It's the characters. But Tom Cruise can still open a movie. I don't know anyone else that still has that power. It's waned, but let the focus be the story. It's not about you, Tom Cruise. I get it. Like, this has been a big part of your life. And you know what? All the way from 1996, like, this has been a long journey. 1996 was the first Mission Impossible movie. So, like, I've grown up with these films as well. I get it. So there was a little bit of, wow, time has moved on. And he is, like, in his mid-60s now. But he is not... I don't think he's the main focus of these in a lot of ways.
It was always a team thing.
And it's not anymore.
It took him a while to figure that out. And then they, after figuring it out, forgot it.
Yeah.
And again, it sucks because it does feel like ego got in the way here.
Yeah.
And maybe they tried to course correct, but because it's such a big bloated production, it was only so much they could do. But yeah, the movie does feel desperate in its editing, and spaced out strangely. I remember I was watching it with a friend of ours, and they had that scene where the guy took the pistol off of one of the soldiers. Nick Offerman took the pistol off him, and then like 45 minutes later, I was like, "Are they going to pay that off?" And then they finally did. And it was like an almost like, "Oh yeah, that's why we did that."
Yeah, they also spent too much time.
It didn't feel satisfying. We didn't know that character, so it was hard to care.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, well, like I said, there's too many characters.
And considering the fate of the world is at stake, the President of the United States is going to drop a bomb on every major country, including her own.
Yeah.
I just don't feel the stakes at all.
Yeah.
And him trying to get the device off of Nathaniel, who's in a different airplane, is the exact same thing that happened in Fallout. Like, the stunts are different, the planes are different, it's planes instead of helicopters, but it is. Like, we have been exactly here before.
Yeah. Also, poor Asai Morales, his Gabriel, is almost an afterthought for this film. We see him in the first sort of act of the movie, and then he is gone for a good hour and a half, and then we go back to him. I mean, he is overshadowed by the more flashier villain, which is the entity.
And Tom Cruise doesn't really get the satisfaction of killing him. Like, he basically kills himself. The entity is basically uploading a virus, like Independence Day or something, right? Like, there's no, like, this satisfying peak of the action.
Yeah.
Nathaniel's death is sudden and kind of shocking when it happens, but the more you think about it, the more... But when after he dies, the more you think about it, the more it's like, ugh, that's not a very good payoff. Like, again, they tried to build him up so much.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Once again, Ethan Hunt manages to fail to do the finishing move on the villain. It's kind of shocking how rarely Ethan takes out the big bad in these movies.
Well, yeah, Gabriel does kill himself. I saw this in the theater, and so that plane chase sequence did look amazing. It was worth the price of admission. I'm also biased because it's also sunny South Africa, so it's like, I've seen that mountain
movie. I lived there,
so I will cop to that. And it is impressive. He also broke a Guinness World Record for the most burning parachutes, the longest parachute burning parachute jump in the film. Like, so you're seeing a Guinness World Record being broken on film, which is also impressive. But you're right, it does feel kind of like a bit of a weak sister to that amazing helicopter chase sequence in Fallout.
We've been exactly here before.
Yeah. So there is that as well. I guess the question is like, how can you make this more? Like, go bigger. Like, does Tom Cruise just, like, self-combust at one end and just, like, dun, 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 end credits? Like, where else could they go?
Almost the only place they could go was what you were saying, was this sort of Christy savior figure. Ethan Hunt would finally make the ultimate sacrifice to save everybody.
See?
But they can't do that because franchise, because Tom Cruise, because they just can't do it.
See, and this
that
is
that would at least have given the movie a fucking ending.
See, and this is where I think they ultimately dropped the ball. I think Ethan should have died.
Yeah.
I think he should have put that chip in the thing, and then, you know, Atwell, that Atwell character, you know, captures the entity, and Ethan dies. I think he shouldn't have survived the film. Yeah. But that's just me. But of course, we had to get the whole, this is the new team at the end, and it will continue. They'll continue to live in the shadows.
But because they spent, like, over $200 million, maybe close to $300 million, and the promotion and everything else, and the movie had to make so much money to be successful that it ended up underperforming.
Yep. But I do like the entity as a villain. You know, it is a blunt statement that the filmmakers are saying about what the internet has become and what is truth. Because honestly, in this day and age, how, especially with the internet, how do you get the truth? Like, this has become a bit of a problem with society where they've actually taken, you know, the creator of Facebook to the Senate and say, like, you have to create rules here where this, and say this is fake, this is not actual information. And that's kind of a terrifying idea for me, you know, with the political right taking over the internet and the manosphere wielding great power, and Facebook and other social media platform websites being flooded with inaccurate information. The truth is kind of like a loaded word these days. You know, like, I'm a teacher, and a student mentioned to me about this research project they're doing, that even with the Google AI, about 45% of what the information they pull up is not
actually not accurate. It's like,
yeah. So it does beg the question, what happens if you get this malicious code that can create a lie and people buy it? And we've seen that, like, it helped get...
Conceptually, I agree with you, but in execution, it just feels like a bland AI that does whatever we need it to do in whatever moment we're in the movie.
Yeah. But, I mean, I did like the idea. Maybe not the execution, which I can agree, but I do like the idea of it as a villain. I mean, once again, they did use Simon Pegg and Peggy Atwell. Well, it was good to see Vin Rames. They gave him a powerful send-off, but
too much,
you took too much. It is a bloated mess, and considering that there are stronger, you know, spy action films out there, including in this series, it was kind of disappointing.
And I don't know what I imagined going in, but I never would have guessed boredom.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think I'm going to end here with, I think they should have done it with the acronym of KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. Yeah. You did too much. You had pinned yourself into a corner. You had to end, you know, the Gabriel narrative, and you were wanting to say goodbye overall. And I don't think you needed all these explanation of the rabbit foot and the Jim Phelps character. Just focus on the entity and what it was doing and incorporate Gabriel. You don't need even the whole nuclear, like, all the, it was trying to shoot off all the nuclear bombs. I think it was too much. Too much, and you needed to tell two very powerful entertainers, keep it simple, stupid.
And again, we've seen so many movies where nuclear weapons are like, you know, the big threat.
Yeah, but
so
that's like, also the TV series as well.
And we've seen so many movies with that final countdown. So on one part, you can admonish it, but on the other part, you just sort of have to accept it's like a gunfight in a cop movie. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But this is the presumably like big finale of the franchise. And for that, ouch. And I kind of feel like they had to know when they released it, it was like lukewarm product at best.
Yeah. I think they were banking on that. They thought they had a lot of fans that like just truly loved the franchise. And you know what? In some ways, I mean, it is a global phenomenon.
People show up for it.
Yeah. But
cut the budget in half and cut the runtime in half, and you still have a series here.
Yeah, but do people really care about the rabbit's foot?
No,
I don't think so, and I think that was part of their mistake there. But also the whole idea of we're going to do this in nonlinear, and nope, and then course correcting. You could tell that it feels kind of like a vapid mess of a film.
Yeah. And, like, if they wanted to make the America James Bond, where every few years we have this big spy globe-trotting thriller, they could do that. But, like, again, don't pretend that there's this great overarching story when there's clearly never been a great overarching story.
And
if your movie is known for its action, be an action movie. Yes, the final entry, there's a little bit of built-in nostalgia, but the running propulsion narrative should be that, like the story that you're telling.
Yeah.
And it feels like the story was the last fucking thing considered here. And as a fan of the franchise, I'm a little insulted.
Yeah. Well, here's something else. If you're wanting to have action beats, like the entity can control all these things, right? Could it not sort of trap Ethan in some sort of factory and then control all these robotic arms, let's say a car factory, and try and kill Ethan that way? Like, show that it's a physical threat where it can control almost anything and cause all this danger to all these innocent people.
Yeah.
That's.
But instead, all these people are just, like, controlled by the entity.
I
don't know about this movie, dude. I was sort of stunned at how much I didn't like it.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Mr. Beckman, Lee Beckman, the Beckman, thank you for accepting this mission.
I chose to accept it.
And for, you know, taking on 8 impossible action movies. I'm glad I did watch them. It was you know, ups and downs, peaks and valleys, as to be expected. But in some measures it lived up to the hype, and in other measures it did not. But no regrets. I don't feel like I need to lick my wounds. And as disappointing or as weak as some of the entries were, there was a lot to say about them, so I wasn't... If it sucked, it wasn't lame in an uninteresting way.
Fair enough. It's no Puppet Master.
That's right. Mr. Beckman, what was your least favorite of the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible franchise, and why?
Because they did it all for the nookie. The nookie, and you can stick it up your... You'll be shocked to know that at number 8, because they did it all for the nookie, and Tom Cruise looked cool climbing a mountain, I chose Mission Impossible 2.
Solid choice.
It's so in love with hunky-hunky Tom Cruise, and in a lot of ways, MI2 is sort of like the quintessential 90s action film. We're seeing sort of the end of that style of action film.
Yeah.
But for a good reason.
If you want to, 2000, but it's the death of the 90s for sure.
Yeah, and so if you want to know why that style of action films are coming to the end, I give you case in point MI2, which kind of hurts because, I mean, I do like John Woo. I think he's a great action filmmaker, but yeah, at number 8, I have Mission Impossible 2. All right, at number 7, it's hard to say goodbye to the ones you love, but I'm going to put Final Reckoning at number 7. It is a bloated mess of a film with too many callbacks and too many characters and too many narratives and just too much. If you just actually, you just sort of focused on the story instead of, hey, remember this from this movie, hey, remember this from this movie, and, you know, cut characters, I think you could have had something. But they had painted themselves into the corner, and that's also just the creative structure style that they had done with these movies. So Final Reckoning I have as number 7. At number 6, and I went back and forth on this, but I have the original Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma's one. I like it. I like that it was probably the closest to the TV series out of all of them. There was that sort of Cold War, you know, who was the mole and who is not, which is big with the TV series as well. It was kind of a big thing that Jim Phelps, the hero, a lot of ways of the TV series, was the big bad. I like it, but I also understand why people don't. So at number 6, I have Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible. At number 5, when I think they started to figure out, you know, what made this TV series, or what made this movie series work as a movie franchise, I have Mission Impossible 3. I think they started to figure out what worked and didn't work. They were still ironing out the details somewhat. But I'll have Mission Impossible 3 at number 5. At number 4, I have Dead Reckoning, where we started to see the flaws show up, but there was still enough good stuff there. But there seemed to be a sort of a sense of familiarity with Dead Reckoning. I think COVID both hurt and helped this movie, but it looked kind of confused. But and also, like the car chase in Rome, we'd seen that before. Yeah. Once again, too many callbacks, too many. But it's still a pretty strong feature. At number 3, I have Ghost Protocol. They started to figure out that the team was probably like the most important element. I mean, they did that somewhat with Dead Reckoning and whatnot, and MI3. But it really seemed like the team was really a good, strong, central fit, much like the TV series. It wasn't all about, you know, Jim Phelps or Ethan Hunt, whatnot, and they used it quite well.
It was a heist.
It was a heist, and some thrilling, you know, action set pieces, especially that climbing of the building. It was really cool. So, at number 3, I have Ghost Protocol, Brad Bird's Ghost Protocol. At number 2, and I went back and forth on this, but number 2, I have Rogue Nation. I think Christopher McQuarrie was the right choice. To take over the franchise. He had a great use of both comedy and action that he used well. It's a really strong, solid action film, and still had that sort of classical old film style somewhat with, you know, with the, I love that the opera sequences and the fight on the catwalks.
Yeah.
And the fact that they figured out that make Ethan suffer. Physically, like, he is beaten to a pulp if you stop and you think about it.
And I will give points to the franchise for that.
Yeah.
Like, that has gone away. The age of Die Hard or Lethal Weapon, yeah, where our heroes look like zombies in the third act.
Yeah.
Now they won't even take a hit. It's,
yeah,
ridiculous.
Well, yeah, no. And that's the thing. That is, it is the hero's journey. They have to overcome something.
That's right.
You know, and so we can at least identify and go along, whether it's, you know, whether it is a man or a woman, doesn't matter. But our hero has a problem that they have to overcome, much like we all do in real life. And I think they were smart enough.
Easy, it doesn't feel heroic.
Yeah, you can't have the whole boss chick stereotype that is very popular with a lot of action films these days. You know, it doesn't even have to be the boss chick stereotype. I'm using that because that is an archetype that is popular right now.
Right.
You want to gravitate and identify and see our protagonists overcome their problems in a lot of ways.
And as we've said before, if the protagonist isn't scared or worried at any time, it's kind of hard for us to be scared or worried at any time.
Exactly. At number one, I have Fallout. I think, like I said, it's a tighter script, crisply edited. I think we've got some great villains here with Solomon Lane and John Lark. Even though the script, if you stop and you think about it, doesn't make logical sense.
How important is that, really?
Yeah, really. At some point, you know, suspension of disbelief. But especially like the first act of that film with that amazing Halo jump, and then we have that really awesome fight sequence, that 1-2 punch. I do like the character of White Widow and how it relates, and we find out that she's the daughter of Max and whatnot, and we get her back, you know, in Dead Reckoning. I thought that was an intriguing character. Ilsa was doing really well in Fallout. Like, all the pieces seemed to work really, really well, and I never felt... That was the one film that I never felt any lag to.
Right.
I think it is a very, very strong action film, and it's bookended by, like I said, it starts off really, once we get that whole interrogation scene, with an amazing Halo jump, which is dangerous, and that amazing helicopter chase sequence, which I think it is great. Like, it really felt... When John Lark, Henry Cavill, looks beaten, like half his face is burnt off, and he just kind of like stands up and just goes, "Oh my God, Ethan is still here. Why?" I even love the face when he realizes that Ethan's chasing him, and he just has this like shaking his head look like, "Really? Really?" Like, we're
he's still here. We're still doing this.
Fine, let me grab my gun and start shooting you. Damn. I don't know. It had some amazing villains, amazing action stunt work. Probably the strongest of the screenplays out of all of them. I think it's a great action film if you love action cinema. Not perfect, but what is? So at number one, I have Mission Impossible Fallout.
Well, I thought we were going to just sort of miss in one spot, but we flipped in two places, as it turns out. So I guess that's a little bit better than if it was just one thing. It might sting a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I think we're mostly on the same page with this. Look, I put Mission Impossible 2 in last place. It surprised me, though, because like, I had to think about it. I remember doing the review saying, man, I really fucking hope this is the worst Mission Impossible movie that I review.
Yeah.
But Final Reckoning, which I agree with you is in seventh place, really kept toying with my patience in a way that, like I got frustrated with the movie. Like,
yeah,
fucking do something.
Yeah.
Seriously, this much money, this much time, this much energy, the last entry in this epic saga.
Yeah.
And this is what you bring us?
Yeah.
For shame, sir. For shame.
Oh, shame.
But Mission Impossible 2 is so tacky and so cringy and so, like, ugh. Like, they did not know what they were at that point. They had not established an identity yet.
Yeah.
Still agreeing with you, in sixth place, I am putting the original Mission Impossible. Some might think that's unkind and how low it is, especially considering the director and considering how loved it was at the time, but... How I feel is how I feel. In fifth place is where we switch again. That's where I put Dead Reckoning. I think the ending of that movie pays off. I really like the train sequence. And like I said, considering it doesn't have an actual ending, it does a good job of being satisfying. And unlike the movie that follows it, it does have a propulsive energy to it, and it does have enough action to justify its runtime. But I think it kind of got dragged down by being attached to the dead cell, which was Final Reckoning. So I edged out Mission Impossible 3, going all the way into fourth position, which might be surprisingly high to some people. Mm. I am very big fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yep.
And I think Tom Cruise does some great acting, and the series kind of grew up a little bit in the third entry. Like,
yeah,
they got through the troubling teenage years in Mission Impossible 2, and now he's a really real boy. Yeah. Mission Impossible.
Today I am a man.
Yeah. In third place, Ghost Protocol, Mission Impossible 5. Now the franchise is confident, it's strutting its stuff, it knows what it is. It's a team film, it's a heist film, it's a stunt film, it's a spectacle film, and the balance is right. Like, the top three are just great action movies. We'll just agree with that, like, wall to wall. I put Fallout in second place because of how much I felt it was a little bit of a repeat of what we've seen before. They tried to go a little bit bigger with it and, like, dress it up a little bit more, but I sort of felt this was familiar ground and kind of a safer entry in a lot of ways. And I just wasn't as satisfied with that third act. But I put Rogue Nation in number one because Ethan is the sort of the true hero in it, that he's completely on the ropes for most of the movie, and then he completely manages to turn that around. Mm-hmm. And the ending was just the most emotionally satisfying for me, where yeah. it was just like all the pieces came together, and I was really glad to... There's something terribly smug about Sean Harris's performance. Mm-hmm. It just like all goes without saying that it's going to work out for him, and it was really great when it didn't. Like, it really paid off. And yeah, the stunt work was great. The screenplay seemed tight and, like, focused and with purpose, not meandering and made up as it goes along, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that one was my favorite. But who knows, maybe if time as I revisit them, that could change. Because, again, other than the first two, these were all based on one pass. But, man, I wish they would have closed out even a little bit stronger. It wouldn't have to be the best one, but it shouldn't be, you know, in discussion for the worst.
Yep.
Was there anything else you'd like to say about Mission Impossible before this self-destructs?
I feel like going for a run.
But in the end, how did we do? Like, did we complete the mission? Do you agree with our assessment? Do you feel as kind of burned by the end of the franchise as I did? Or I would love to hear feedback. And there's a place where you can send that feedback. And it's rankandreview@gmail.com. That's RANKNREVIEW@gmail.com. The website is rankandreview.ca. There is a Rank and Review presence on YouTube that you should maybe consider checking out, and throwing a like, throwing a subscribe, throw your ranks of a given podcast underneath the episode. Why not share with me and the rest of us what you think. Where did we get it right? Where did we get it wrong? Rank and Review drops every other Wednesday, and we eagerly await your ears for further episodes in this, the 12th season of Rank and Review, leading up to the big bad 300th episode. Thank you so much for your ears. By listening, you are my friend.